Hello and welcome back to our digital class on soft condensed matter. This is its fourth lesson unit and the second one out of our block on rheology. Our last lesson unit has given us an introduction to the field of rheology. We have seen what rheology is. It's the understanding of flow, the branch of physics and chemistry that deals with mechanical behavior of materials. We have seen that there is basically two elementary cases of material mechanical responses. Elastic solids, which obey Hooke's law, and viscous fluids, which obey Newton's law. These two are characterized by two elementary material parameters, which is the elastic modulus, often also named Young's modulus, having a variant form which is named shear modulus, and the viscosity. Both these quantities can be viewed as macroscopic engineering parameters, telling us how much resistance a material will exert against the attempt to deform it, and as microscopic structural parameters that have to do with what kinds of building blocks are in the material, specifically how large they are, how strongly they interact, and how long it takes for them to move over distances equal to their own size and switch positions against each other. We've also seen that categorizing materials to be either elastic solids or viscous liquids is actually oversimplifying. Many materials, strictly speaking all materials, can display intermediate behavior, which we name viscoelastic. The decisive quantity here is a microscopic one, the relaxation time, which is the timescale it takes for the building blocks in the material to move distances as far as they are big, and thereby being able to switch their positions against each other. This is nothing else than the microscopic mechanism of what we macroscopically observe as flow. This means any matter, if given times longer than its relaxation time, will display viscous flow. And vice versa, on timescales shorter than the relaxation time, any matter will display elastic properties. Whether we name a material elastic solid or viscous liquid does therefore depend on what its relaxation time is and what our timescale of observation is. In many classical materials, the relaxation time is either very short, so that they always display their viscous properties, or very long, so that they always display their elastic properties. For soft matter, however, the relaxation time is typically in the range of practically relevant timescales, of milliseconds to seconds, sometimes up to minutes and hours. This means soft matter very often displays the characteristics of both viscous liquids and elastic solids, exhibiting fascinating viscoelastic properties. All that is of prime relevance for materials engineering, and so rheology is a very important methodology in the realm of materials science. It can be conducted by various different forms, three of which we have gotten to know in our last lesson unit. The stereotype rheological experiments are the relaxation experiment, the creep test, and the dynamic experiment. In this present lesson unit, we want to dive deeper into this and get a deeper understanding of how exactly these experiments are conducted practically and how we can theoretically model the mechanical characteristics of viscoelastic materials. Let us start with looking on the methodology in rheology. We have seen in our last lesson unit that the most insightful kind of experiment is an oscillatory experiment. There is many ways of how this can be conducted practically. The most common and practically useful one is the method of oscillatory shear rheology. Here we use an experimental setup as sketched in figure 4.9. We have a measuring setup geometry, which either consists of two parallel plates, as shown in figure 4.9a, or of a plate and a cone, as shown in figure 4.9b, both being side view perspectives on the instrument. Our sample specimen, in this figure indicated by a light blue area, is immersed between these two geometries and then set under oscillatory shear deformation by turning the upper geometry in a controlled oscillatory fashion with a motor. This results in a torque, which is exerted by the sample medium's resistance in between the two plates. And from this torque, the values of the moduli can be calculated. We know from our previous lesson unit that these are the real and imaginary parts of a complex quantity. In our experiment, this will be manifesting itself such that there will be a phase angle between the oscillatory condition that we apply and the resulting oscillatory response. From this phase angle, we can calculate the two parts of the complex elastic modulus, which also translate in a corresponding complex viscosity. This has been expressed in equations 4.13 and 4.14 in our last lesson unit. Both the measuring geometries shown in figure 4.9 can be used to determine these quantities. It's practical reasons that make us use either the plate-plate or the cone-plate geometry in a practical case given at hand. Commonly, the cone plate geometry is more suitable because here the extent of shear is homogeneous over the sample. Since the upper geometry has a circular cross-section, sample regions in the outer rim of this will be more displaced in the direction of the rotation than sample regions closer to the center of the geometry. This, however, is compensated if also the sample height is greater in the outer region than in the inner region. And that is realized by using a cone plate geometry. Some sample types, however, preclude the use of such geometries. For example, particle suspensions, where we have particle sizes that in the inner center of a cone plate geometry would come close to the distances from the floor to the top here. And in that case, it's better to use a plate-plate geometry where we have an equal plate-plate distance over the whole sample specimen that is at least 10 times the particle size in the sample, better even more. As a result, polymer solutions or melts are usually often more measured with a cone plate geometry, whereas colloidal particle suspensions are usually more often measured with a plate-plate geometry. This method of oscillatory shear rheology is very widespread, versatile, and robust in application. It has, however, one drawback. The measuring geometries have macroscopic dimensions. Usual diameters of these cones and plates are in the range of a few centimeters. This consumes considerable amount of samples, usually around a milliliter, which can be quite a lot if the sample material that we measure is something that has been self-synthesized in the laboratory before, which often turns out to give us not much more than a couple milligrams. And second, due to its macroscopic dimension, these methodologies average over potential spatial heterogeneities in the samples, which we may be interested in recognizing and resolving. To account for that, another important type of methodology is microrheology. In this case, nano or micrometer-sized probe particles are immersed in the sample and then explore it. They explore the mechanical characteristics of their surrounding. This is done by quantifying the ease or non-ease of the movement of these probes through the sample medium, which of course has to do with the surrounding sample's viscoelastic characteristics. As these probe particles are small, this information is obtained on a local, microscopic scale. There are basically two variants of microrheology: active microrheology and passive microrheology. In active microrheology, as the name tells us, we actively manipulate the particles in the sample specimen. A prime example is the active microrheological method of magnetic bead rheometry. Here, our sample is loaded with little spherical magnetic particles that can be moved by the application of an external magnetic field, either linearly or also in an oscillatory fashion. The magnetic force exerted onto such a particle is related to the product of the magnetic moment induced in the particle and the external field gradient, which can also be expressed as the magnetic susceptibility of the bead multiplied by its volume and the external field strength times its gradient, as denoted in equation 4.21. The resulting displacement of the bead of the particle can then be monitored by suitable microscopic techniques. Often common light microscopy is perfectly fine to do that. And then translate it into the viscoelastic properties of the surrounding sample medium in a spatially resolved fashion. In a purely viscous medium, the application of a constant magnetic force accelerates the probe particles, which is accompanied by the emergence of a counteracting frictional force. This force is related to the particle's velocity and the friction coefficient, which in the most simple form can be quantified by Stokes' law to be 6 pi eta r, wherein which eta is the viscosity of the surrounding medium and r the size of the probe particles, as given in equation 4.22. Together with equation 4.21, at known magnetic field strength gradient and the particle's magnetic characteristics, this means we only need to measure the particle velocity under the influence of such an external field, and can thereby calculate the sample medium's surrounding viscosity. We can also conduct such an experiment in a dynamic fashion by sinusoidally modulating the external magnetic field. The resulting time-dependent displacement of the particles is then also sinusoidally modulated, potentially displaying a phase angle to the external sinusoidal modulation of the accelerating field, as expressed in equation 4.23. Using Euler's formula, we can then find the frequency-dependent storage and loss moduli, G prime and G double prime, as denoted in equations 4.24 and 4.25. A second variant of conducting microrheology is passive microrheology. Here, we do not apply an external force to put our probe particles into motion, but let the ever-present thermal energy do that. What we probe here is the particles' random motion, their time-dependent mean-square displacement, and derive the surrounding sample's viscoelastic properties from that quantity. When we recall our elementary physical chemistry education, we remember that in a purely viscous medium, a diffusing probe particle or molecule displays pure Fickian diffusion. In this case, its mean square displacement is given by the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation, 4.26, which relates the mean square displacement of a diffusing molecule or particle linearly to time, with a constant of proportionality being the translational diffusion coefficient, and a geometry factor, which is 6 in the case of 3 dimensions. Together with the Stokes-Einstein equation for the diffusion of spherical particles in a purely viscous medium, we can express the sample's viscosity as given in equation 4.27. Eta equals thermal energy, kBT, over 6 pi dr. And if we now replace the d by equation 4.26, we obtain the right-hand side notation of equation 4.27. If, by contrast, we do passive microrheology in a purely elastic medium, the diffusion of our probe particles will be constrained. They may be able to move a certain short distance, during which they do not realize yet that they are constrained by the surrounding solid elastic medium. But as soon as they feel the elastic trapping of their surroundings, they cannot move further. This is plotted in figure 4.10. Here we see the time-dependent mean square displacement, which initially raises linearly and then bends over into a plateau. This limits the motion of the particles to an extent as allowed by the elasticity of the surrounding medium. We can express this maximally allowed displacement of our particles by a term according to Hooke's law and balance this elastic energy type of expression to the driving thermal energy, as done in equation 4.28. This equation contains a factor kappa, which is some sort of a spring constant here, and that is related to the elastic part of the modulus, as given in equation 4.29. The intermediate case of a viscoelastic medium has to do with the intermediate part of the curve in figure 4.10. Here, the probe particles do partially, but not yet fully, experience elastic constraint on their diffusive motion. In this range, the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation 4.26 must be extended by an exponent, alpha, which turns out to also be time-dependent, as expressed in equation 4.30. This is a generalized Einstein-Smoluchowski equation. In a purely viscous medium, the exponent alpha is 1, and then equation 4.30 turns into the usual notation of the Einstein-Smoluchowski equation 4.26. Here, probe particles or molecules can diffuse freely, causing in a linear race of their mean square displacement. By contrast, in a purely elastic medium, the exponent alpha is 0, and we find ourselves in a plateau of the probe's mean square displacement, as has just been discussed in the context of the long time limit of figure 4.10. When alpha is between these two extremes, between 0 and 1, then the probe displacement is called subdiffusive. A diffusing probe, particle, or molecule then exhibits a mean square displacement that is less than linear in time, which indicates already that there is some kind of hindrance on the particle motion. This is the case if the surrounding medium has both viscous and elastic properties. The curve in figure 4.10 actually shows this. It shows that the exponent alpha is time dependent. If we would plot this curve in a log-log representation, then alpha would be the slope of it. In the initial stage, at short times, we would have this slope, this alpha being 1. At long times, in the plateau, we would have this slope, meaning this alpha being 0, and at intermediate times, we would have values in between those two. From this very parameter, from the time-dependent alpha, the complex modulus with its two parts, g prime and g double prime, can be determined. There's multiple algorithms or ways of how this is done. A classical one has been introduced by Mason and Waitz, as given in equations 4.31, 4.32, and 4.33. Okay, after having detailed on this experimental side of rheology, let us now switch perspectives and take a theoretical perspective. We have seen already multiple times that many materials, strictly speaking all materials, are viscoelastic, depending on timescales, and as we will see later on, also on temperature, by the way. The very general attempt in science is to describe nature with models, to come up with simplifying models that allow us to describe a part of nature in a simplified fashion. Ideally, we seek for quantitative descriptions, formulas. Here, in our case, we're interested in mechanical models. Models that are simplified, giving us equations. For example, the stress relaxation or the creep behavior of viscoelastic materials in the form of quantitative formulas. The ingredients for these models have already been introduced to us in our last lesson unit. We have seen that the elementary case of an elastic solid can be described by a spring mechanical element, whereas viscous liquids can be described by a dashpot element. We can now guess already that a very simplified mechanical model to describe viscoelastic materials will be to combine these two. And there is two basic forms of how we can combine these two. We can set them in series or we can set them parallel. These two approaches give us two very simple but nevertheless quite powerful mechanical models for viscoelastic materials, the Maxwell model and the Kelvin-Voigt model. In the Maxwell model, we combine spring and dashpot in series, as shown in figure 4.11. When stress is applied to this element by an external deforming force, the elastic spring element deforms instantly, followed by a delayed, irreversible deformation of the viscous dashpot element that relaxes the stress in the deformed spring as far as possible. If that relaxation is not allowed to come to completion, there will be a residual stress in the system if the external load persists. But once this external stress is released, then the spring element will snap back to its original position, whereas the dashpot element will remain deformed irreversibly. Let us put this into equations. What can we say about this Maxwell element mathematically? Well, first we can say that any deformation applied to it is the sum of the individual deformations of its two parts, as it's expressed in equation 4.34. The total strain, epsilon, summarizes from the strains of its viscous and elastic parts. This does also apply to the rate of deformation, which is the time derivative of this, as denoted in equation 4.35. On the other hand, the stress in this element, which arises from external straining, will be the same in both elements. The total stress is felt both in the viscous and in the elastic part, as denoted in equation 4.36. For the two parts, we can set up elementary equations. The elastic contribution to the Maxwell element is given by Hooke's law, which we here write in a differential form, as done in equation 4.37. The viscous contribution in the dashpot part is described by Newton's law, as denoted in equation 4.38. We can now use these two latter equations and set them into equation 4.35 to generate equation 4.39. This is the basic differential equation for the Maxwell element. We can solve this differential equation under the assumption of certain boundary conditions. Let the boundary condition be constant deformation, meaning the time derivative of the strain being zero. In this case, we can set the left-hand side of the equation 4.39 zero and then solve the differential equation, which gives us equation 4.40. This is a stress relaxation function. It gives us the time-dependent stress in the form of an exponential decay. The middle form of this equation is what results from solving the differential equation 4.39, and the right-hand side notation is a generalized form where we express the exponential as we usually do it when we have exponential decays, e to the minus t over tau, where tau is a relaxation time, which mathematically tells us what time it takes for the quantity that we regard, here the time-dependent stress, to relax to a residual value of 1 over e of its initial. When comparing these two notations of the equation, we can identify already a very important fundamental identity. E over eta from the middle notation of this equation is the same as 1 over tau from the right-hand side notation of this equation. Rearranged, this means that eta is e times tau. And this is a super elementary identity in the field of rheology. We have found it as a sort of a byproduct of this derivation here. In our next lesson unit, we will also derive this again more properly. We can basically understand it from a very simplifying viewpoint already. Viscosity is equal to modulus times relaxation time. This makes somehow sense, huh? Viscosity tells us how hard it is for a material to rearrange its building blocks, to flow. And this does, of course, have to do with how much energy a material can store initially and how long it takes to relax that. The finding of equation 4.40 from the Maxwell element shows us that it's apparently very suitable to describe the stress relaxation of viscoelastic fluids. This is graphically visualized in the left-hand side part of figure 4.12. This resembles a notation that we have already discussed in our last lesson unit. If we apply a step-like strain profile to this element, the result will be an exponential relaxation of the initially built-up stress in the element. And we can also understand this conceptually. This is basically what we have just discussed before doing the calculation. When we stepwise deform the Maxwell element, its elastic part, the spring, will respond instantly, being put under stress then, whereas the damper element, the dashpot element, will respond in a delayed fashion, relieving the stress stored in the spring. By contrast, the other kind of experiment, as shown on the right-hand side of figure 4.12, the creep test, is not so nicely representable by the Maxwell element. Conceptually, it would respond as shown on the lower right in figure 4.12. When putting the Maxwell element under constant strain according to a box profile as shown in the upper right in figure 4.12, we would have an initial response by its spring element and then a delayed response, a linear elongation of the dashpot element. This is what also the diagram in the lower right of this figure shows to us. If we recall how creep curves for viscoelastic materials actually look like, however, then we may recognize already that here this model is oversimplifying. Actual creep curves do not look like this profile shown in the lower right of the present diagram, but have a bend form. And even worse, this kind of curve is not even represented mathematically from the Maxwell model. When we reconsider its elementary differential equation 4.39, the case of application of constant stress to the element would mean that delta sigma over delta t will be zero. This means the second summand on the right-hand side of equation 4.39 will then be gone. The equation will then reduce to delta epsilon over delta t is sigma over eta. And this is nothing else than Newton's law. We can multiply the eta to the other side and then obtain an equation saying sigma is equal to eta times delta epsilon over delta t. This is Newton's law. If we would plot that, the result would be something like shown on the lower right of figure 4.12, without the initial and the final step, but only a linearly increasing profile. This means in this case, the Maxwell element reduces to only its dashpot element, to only its viscous part. As a result, we can conclude that this model is very strong in describing the stress relaxation of viscoelastic liquids, but not so good in describing the creep of viscoelastic solids. Instead, that kind of experimental case is better captured by the other model, by the Kelvin-Voigt model, which we will discuss in a minute. Before coming to this, let us further stay with the Maxwell model to discuss its behavior under oscillatory deformation, which, as we have seen, is the most relevant and insightful type of experimental situation. In a dynamic experiment, we apply a sinusoidally modulated strain, as denoted in equation 4.45. This will make us measure a corresponding sinusoidally modulated stress, as denoted in equation 4.46, commonly displaying a phase angle to the experimental condition. We now use those two profiles and put them into the elementary differential equation of the Maxwell element. For that, we need them in a time derivative form, as denoted to us in equations 4.47 and 4.48. Again, we start our quantitative consideration with the fundamental differential equation for the Maxwell element, 4.39, which we now artificially expand by a factor of 1, which we write as eta over eta on its right-hand side, because this does allow us to elegantly rearrange the equation further. This is given to us in equation 4.49. We then take this equation and apply the fundamental equation eta is modulus times relaxation time that we came across in our earlier quantitative consideration of the Maxwell element, both to its left-hand side and to its right-hand side, turning it into equation 4.50. That one we now take and plug in the time derivatives of the complex exponential sinusoidally modulated stress and strain from equations 4.47 and 4.48, giving us equation 4.51. With some complex exponential calculus, this can be rearranged to equation 4.52, which makes us identify the two parts of the elastic moduli again. E prime, the storage modulus, and E double prime, the loss modulus, both in a frequency-dependent form, as denoted in equations 4.53 and 4.54. A completely analogous calculation can be made for the complex oscillatory shear modulus, G, by the way. Let us examine these two latter equations more closely, and do so by focusing on two extreme frequency ranges, the high and the low one. At low frequencies, the denominators of both the latter equations have a value close to 1, because then the term tau 0 square times omega square in both cases is very small, as omega is very small then, and therefore negligible compared to the 1, which is also present in both denominators. Then the two numerators give us the frequency dependence of these two moduli components, telling us that in a log-log plot, they both will have a linear appearance, whereby E prime has a slope of 2 in this representation, whereas E double prime has a slope of 1. At high frequencies, by contrast, the tau zero squared times omega squared terms in both denominators of equations 4.53 and 4.54 is much larger than the one in them, such that the latter can be neglected. Then many of the variables in the numerators and the denominators cancel, giving us a frequency dependence of omega with a power law exponent of 0 for E prime and omega with a power law exponent of minus 1 for E double prime. This is plotted in figure 4.13. Here we see a log-log representation of the frequency dependent modulus. We see two curves, one for its real part, E prime, storage modulus, and one for its imaginary part, E double prime, the loss modulus. And as we have just seen, in the limit of low frequencies, we have linear scalings in this log-log representation with slopes of 1 and 2, whereas in the limit of high frequencies, the real part, storage modulus, levels off in a frequency-independent plateau, whereas the imaginary part, the loss modulus, drops, again as a power law, which has a linear form in a log-log representation with a slope of minus 1. The point where the one turns into the other is at a very characteristic time, tau zero, the relaxation time, where the two moduli will have equal values. The curves cross at this point at a value of the half of the plateau modulus. We can make ourselves this clear by plugging in omega being 1 over tau zero into equations 4.53 and 4.54. In both cases, this will make the omega or omega square cancel against the tau zero or tau zero square in the numerators of these equations and make the omega square tau zero square term 1 in the denominators of the equations, resulting in a value of E half for both. This result that we got to on a mathematical pathway has a lot of conceptual insight. If we look under the low frequency regime, we see that here the imaginary part of the modulus is greater than its real part, meaning here the properties of the sample are more viscous than elastic. And this makes sense. Low frequencies correspond to long times, longer than the relaxation time. And on those timescales, the material has enough time for its building blocks to move against each other and to display flow. And it does so the more time we give it, meaning the lower the frequencies are that we regard. As a result, the unequal power law scaling of 1 and 2 in this range make the difference between the superior E double prime and the inferior E prime bigger the more we go to the left of this diagram, the lower the frequencies are. By contrast, in the realm of high frequencies, the opposite is the case. Here, E prime outweighs E double prime. More and more, the more we go to the right on the axis, the more we go to high frequencies. Because high frequencies correspond to short times, shorter than the relaxation time. And in this range, the building blocks of material do not have enough time to move and displace against each other, rendering the material elastic. The more, the less time we give it, meaning the more we go to high frequencies. At the relaxation time, we have the transition between these two regimes. Here, the building blocks are, for the first time, exactly able to displace distances equal to their own size, and this corresponds to the transition from the elastic regime at short times or high frequencies to the viscous regime at long times or low frequencies. And it's somehow logical that at this transition point, the material shows equal contribution of both these parts, meaning the two moduli curves cross at a value of 1/2 of the plateau value. This discussion was already formulated for an actual material. We can also formulate it for the simplifying Maxwell element from figure 4.11. At long times, at low frequencies, the time is long enough for the dashpot element to relax the energy stored in the spring. As a result, at such long timescales, the Maxwell element's mechanical properties are dominated by its viscous part. This becomes more and more dominant the longer the timescales is, or in turn, the lower the frequency is. At high frequencies, the picture is opposite. Here, there is not enough time for the dashpot element to relax. And so, on those timescales, the Maxwell element's mechanical response is dominated by its elastic part, by its spring part. This becomes more and more dominant the shorter the timescale is, or in turn, the higher the frequency is. Soft matter, like polymers and colloids, is built up of building blocks which are comparably large. This corresponds to timescales for migration over such distances for timescales of the relaxation time in the range of milliseconds to seconds, sometimes even minutes up to hours. This renders many soft matter materials strikingly viscoelastic, and it's also very advantageous for elementary science, because this relatively slow motion makes relaxation processes observable. the same basic processes that are also present in common low molar mass materials, such as common fluids, which are built up of small and fastly moving molecules, do also happen in colloidal scale matter, with the only difference that here they take longer and occur with building blocks that have sizes that are actually observable quite easily. The knowledge that we then gain on the microscopic course of, for example, phase transitions can then be transferred also to normal matter systems, which are not as easy to observe directly. It was this insight that brought the French physicist Pierre-Gilles de Gennes the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1991. And during his Nobel Prize speech, for the first time he introduced the term soft matter. The latter consideration has shown to us how powerful the Maxwell element is. As simple as it is in its construction, it's actually very powerful in quantitatively describing viscoelastic materials. We have just encountered one shortcoming. It's not so good to describe the creep behavior of viscoelastic solids. For that purpose, another model is more suitable, the Kelvin-Voigt model, which is also composed of one dashpot and one spring element, with a difference to the Maxwell model that now these are arranged parallel to each other rather than in series, as shown in figure 4.14a. Upon application of a constant stress, this Kelvin-Voigt element exhibits creep and deforms at a decreasing rate, asymptotically approaching a steady state strain, given as sigma 0 over E. When the stress is released, the element gradually relaxes back to its undeformed state. This is shown in figure 4.14b. Since the deformation in this case is reversible, even though not being so suddenly, the Kelvin-Voigt model describes an elastic solid that also exhibits some viscous contribution, a viscoelastic solid. We can also quantify this. Here, in contrast to the Maxwell element, a simple geometrical need tells us that not the strain is additive, as it was in the Maxwell element, but by contrast, the stress is additive. The total stress on the Kelvin-Voigt model is the sum of the stress onto its two elements, whereas in this case, its overall strain is and has to be equally shared by two elements. This means the total strain is the same in the dashpot and the spring element, whereas the total stress is the sum of the two. We can express the elastic contribution to the Kelvin-Voigt model by setting up Hooke's law for its spring element, as done in equation 4.55, and by doing so similarly for its viscous contribution by setting up Newton's law for its dashpot element, as done in equation 4.56. We now take these two equations and plug them into the elementary condition that the total stress is the sum of the two individual ones, giving us equation 4.57. This is again a differential equation, which is the basic differential equation for the Kelvin-Voigt element. Solving this differential equation under suitable boundary conditions, which here shall be a constant applied stress of sigma 0, gives us equation 4.58. This has the form of an exponential build-up curve, a creep curve, again containing a characteristic time parameter, which is the so-called retardation time. Figure 4.15b shows us this behavior. Upon application of an external stress in the form of a box profile, the Kelvin-Voigt element results with a creep behavior, as mathematically given by equation 4.58, and as can also be conceptualized quite easily by considering that external stress requires the spring to be stretched, but this can only be done when the damper follows it, so it occurs retarded in time, at greater and greater resistance energy the further we expand the spring, according to the Hookean deformation, in which the energy raises with a square of the extent of deformation. With that, the Kelvin-Voigt model nicely complements the Maxwell model. The Kelvin-Voigt model is good to quantify creep of viscoelastic solids, whereas the Maxwell model is good to quantify stress relaxation of viscoelastic liquids. In some cases, it may be desirable to set up further complicated models being suitable of describing both. And that can be done in multiple ways by combining two spring and two dashpot elements. And there is multiple ways of how this can be done geometrically. The most famous one is the Burgers model, which is sort of a combination of both a Maxwell and a Kelvin-Voigt element, as shown in the right-hand side of figure 4.15. The diagram on the left-hand side of this figure shows us the time-dependent strain behavior of this element when being put under constant external stress. These curves actually very much look alike the creeping curve that actual viscoelastic materials show. We can get a mathematical representation for this model following the same formalism that we have also used before for the Maxwell and the Kelvin-Voigt model. We simply make us clear that there are three sections in this element, in this model, and that the total strain of the element will be the sum of those three. This is quantified in equation 4.59. Secondly, we make us clear that the stress is equal in all the three sections, like it also is in the Maxwell model, as noted down in equation 4.60. According to the Kelvin-Voigt model, the total stress in the second section, in the middle section, is the sum of the elastic and the viscous elements in it, as noted in equation 4.61. And if we then plug everything together, we can generate equation 4.62, which gives the time-dependent strain of the Burgers model. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. It has given us a secondary, detailed view on both the experimentation and theory of rheology. We get to know complementary experimental techniques to probe the mechanical characteristics of materials from both macroscopic and microscopic viewpoints. And we got to know complementary theoretical models to describe their viscoelastic behavior. These models turned out to be not overly complicated, but giving us equations that are actually very powerful in describing the time or frequency-dependent stress and strain behavior of viscoelastic materials. It will now be our further goal to apply this to the actual mechanical characteristics of soft matter. To becoming able to do so, we first must know how they are, and as it turns out, they can be very versatile, depending on the timescale we consider. As the relaxation times of soft matter are typically in the ranges of milliseconds to seconds, sometimes even minutes up to hours, the mechanical behavior of those are very different and diverse over many orders of magnitude in time. This means in experiments we must probe quite considerable time ranges, or correspondingly frequency ranges. And this is demanding experimentally, as it makes experimentation very long. Fortunately, however, there is another very elementary principle in nature, namely that the relaxation processes in material that contribute to its rich mechanical versatility are all thermally activated. And this means temperature is another very relevant variable to be considered here. That will be the goal of our next lesson unit.